We are talking once again with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchik, local writers and activists here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Let's dive into the start with the Seattle City Council and actions they have taken this week.
Yeah, this week on Monday, the council voted the 2021 budget out of the budget committee along with one more amendment, which was introduced at the last minute by Teresa Mosqueda. Advocates for defunding the police by 50% were disappointed that the council hadn't done that in the 2021 budget. So they pushed hard for the council to at least continue Mayor Durkan's hiring freeze in the Seattle Police Department through the end of next year. The hiring freeze, of course, is set to expire on December 31st of this year. Shama Sawant had proposed an amendment to continue the hiring freeze, but Teresa Mosqueda didn't include it in the balancing package. Instead, she grouped it along with several other amendments that were proposed by Shama Sawant into a package C that was voted down by the other council members. When defund advocates pointed out that the balancing package would lead to a net increase in Seattle Police Department staff at the end of 2021, Teresa Mosqueda wrote up a last-minute amendment to cut $2 million from the Seattle Police Department budget to reflect what is called in the amendment greater than planned attrition in 2021 to the tune of about 25 additional positions in the department, which would just kind of coincidentally bring the 2021 Seattle Police Department staffing budget down to reflect a net zero increase in personnel in 2021. Now, this caused an outcry from the mainstream media and pro-business factions in the city, including the lobbying group Change Washington, who I'm going to talk about here a little bit later. But they all said it was political pandering to the defund movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, and that it would weaken the Seattle Police Department's ability to fight crime. But then let's just remember that the personnel cuts to the Seattle Police Department in the 2021 budget amount to only 6.5% of the department. This is after years and years of double-digit growth. Okay, I mean, I've lived in the city for almost 40 years, and I've never seen the Seattle Police Department budget cut once, you know, in the years that I've lived here. And that's including some years where we've had terrible economic conditions and the city has obviously not had enough money to fund everything in the budget. And all other city departments took cuts except for the Seattle Police Department. So this is a historic first. But it's only a 6.5% cut in the number of personnel, and that's not going to make any difference, really, for 911 response times or the Seattle Police Department's ability to handle violent crime. But that hasn't stopped the local pundits and conservative lobbyists and business groups from complaining about what they see as an increase in crime. Now, the Seattle Police Department's own statistics show that crime has actually fallen, especially violent crime. What hasn't fallen, especially this year, are nuisances or perceived nuisances caused by the COVID-19 shutdown, like graffiti, litter, shoplifting, and boarded up buildings, where the boards provide a lot of space for graffiti, for example. And let's not forget that unemployment can lead a lot of people to commit property crimes like shoplifting in order to get their basic needs met, right? Now, those kinds of crimes are always on the increase when an economy is bad, like it is right now. Now, other perceived nuisances, like the presence of homeless folks sleeping in doorways and tent encampments, really hasn't changed much from previous years, in the last decade. The difference is that now the city is not pushing people around from place to place anymore at the behest of business owners. That's the one big difference. And, of course, with more Seattle residents gathering and exercising outdoors because of COVID-19, there's a perception that the streets of Seattle are dirtier and more dangerous, when, in fact, the city pretty much looks the same to me, except for more darkness in storefronts and restaurants, and more boards over storefronts and restaurant windows. In fact, I think the number of homeless people that I've seen sleeping on the streets this year is actually less now because of the increase in emergency shelter and efforts to get some of the chronically homeless folks the services that they need to get them stabilized and off the street. I think the homeless situation has actually gotten better in the last year than it's been in prior years. And I've been out on the street. I mean, I don't own a car. I walk everywhere. I take the bus a lot. And I'm on the street every day. And I think that I'm seeing fewer homeless people camping out and just kind of hanging out on the streets than I have in past years. Now, I think pre-COVID-19, it was just really easy for business owners and Seattle residents to ignore the homeless problem because of the navigation team just moving people around whenever anybody called in a complaint, and because people were spending more time indoors and in their cars and less time out walking on the streets and exercising on the streets. And now we just can't ignore it. I mean, it's there. More people are seeing it, and they're concerned, and they should have been concerned, you know, 8 years ago after the housing crisis happened and so many people were dumped out on the street. But it's just now that a lot of people are actually seeing the problem. But of course, the solution is not to hire more police, right? It's to provide more housing and services for the chronically homeless. It's to provide affordable housing that doesn't, you know, kick people out on the street. That's the solution, right? The solution isn't, you know, send a man with a gun. I mean, that's the point of the folks who are talking about defund the police, right? So I want to talk for a second, too. There was a great article on Erica Barnett's blog, The C is for Crank, which is now part of the website Publicola, about a mysterious lobbying group that was spearheading an effort to get Seattle residents to contact the press and the city council to oppose cuts to the Seattle Police Department. And that lobbying group is called Change Washington. Now, many of the canned messages that the groups suggested that people send were misleading, inaccurate, and highly emotional, using statements like, "I am terrified," "My neighborhood won't survive," and "you have lost touch with reality," you know, the little exclamation point at the end to kind of, you know, double down on the idea that, you know, people truly are terrified because they've seen a couple of hypodermic needles on the street or they've run into a couple of homeless people. Now,
sounds like talk radio, honestly.
It does, yeah. Now, Barnett points out that Change Washington is a 501c4 organization that was founded by a former senator in the Washington State Legislature named Rodney Tom, who ran as a Democrat in order to get elected, but then ended up caucusing with the Republicans instead.
He was actually considered a very moderate Republican. What happened?
Yeah, I know. And I should point out, too, that Tom represented a district in Bellevue where he lives. He does not live in Seattle. So it's kind of interesting that he started this organization to comment on Seattle politics when he actually lives in Bellevue. Now, Change Washington is staffed by the two partners who started the public relations firm Toso Weiland, Aaron Toso and Josh Weiland. Toso is the former head of community engagement and public policy communications for Amazon. Weiland is a former PR flack for Alcoa, Inc. And notably, Toso Weiland is not based in Seattle. Their address of record is in Snoqualmie, Washington. And I don't think either Toso or Weiland live in Seattle either. Now, because the city of Seattle doesn't require lobbying groups to list their donors, Erica Barnett wasn't able to determine who exactly is funding Change Washington and how much each person or company or group has given for this campaign in particular. But she did point out that the city council will be considering legislation in December that could require lobbying groups in the city of Seattle to register with the city and provide information on who's giving them money, who their message is directed to, and what legislation they're targeting. The city currently requires individual lobbyists who directly lobby the mayor and city council to register with the city. And it also requires any groups that seek to influence elections to register and provide the amount of money that they've given to each political campaign, but not their list of donors. And this would be in addition to that. That bill is set to be discussed in early December if the city council doesn't put it off until after the new year. So that's a possibility. Now, there's also a downside to that bill, too. Because as those of us who have worked in progressive politics know, a lot of progressive organizations, particularly far left organizations, have been targeted by governments in the past to give up their list of donors and their membership roles. So that means that this kind of a bill would mean that any grassroots group that is working to lobby city government for any reason at all would also probably have to give a list of their donors as well. So that's the double-edged sword there within that bill. And there may be opposition to that bill from both the left and the right. And it may be really hard for the city council to pass that. So we'll just have to see what happens when they bring that up for discussion in early December. Probably about a week or week and a half from now. Now, on the other side of the response to the city council budget are the folks who have been lobbying to defund the Seattle Police Department by 50%. Those folks are also unhappy with the 2021 budget. And there's been kind of a hue and cry to replace members of the city council to say, oh, the city council has failed us. You know, they're not moving fast enough. They're not progressive enough. And I just want to say, I think you folks are dreaming if you think you're going to get a better city council to do this kind of work. And I just want to say, you know, people wanting steeper cuts and making calls to get a better city council, you need to take a broader look at what's actually happening in Seattle politics. There is going to be a huge move to try to replace the current city council with more conservative city council members. In the next year, Teresa Mosqueda and Lorena Gonzalez are going to be up for re-election in the all-city seats, the two all-city positions. And it's going to be a huge struggle for them, I think, to get re-elected if they decide to run for re-election. And there are going to be some major candidates put up against them. So that's going to be at issue, too. But I think we need to think, too, about diversity of tactics here. A lot of folks who have been protesting in the street feel like their protests have not led to the kind of solution that they want, you know. But I think we need to remember that nonviolent change occurs through a diversity of tactics. It isn't just people who are gathering on the street to protest that make that change. That's just one element of it. You have to also look at the folks who are doing really serious political work to try to reorient the ship of city politics in a new direction. And that takes time. It takes a lot of effort. And also we need to ask ourselves, what is the long-term goal? The long-term goal is not defund the police by 50%. Defund the police by 50% is a slogan, right? It's not even an interim goal. It's just a slogan that represents the long-term goal. And the long-term goal is that when someone calls 911, that it isn't always a man or a woman with a gun who shows up in response. The long-term goal is that when a man or a woman with a gun do show up, that all people of color be treated exactly the same way a white person would be treated, with some respect and an attempt to de-escalate violence rather than to just shoot whoever appears to be the problem. That's the long-term goal, right? The long-term goal is to unwind institutional racism and address institutional racism. I mean, those are the long-term goals.
I would add to that that the long-term goal also is to have real legal accountability for those guys with guns who do show up and cross the line.
Yeah, exactly.
And we do not have anything approaching that in local politics yet.
The one exception to that is that
you know, the city is supposedly negotiating a new contract with the Seattle Police Officers Guild, and that has been the major impediment in the past to accountability, because the city and past mayors and the current mayor as well have been completely uninterested in demanding accountability of rank and file cops.
And the big change this year in the coming negotiations that are going to start after the first of the year is that there are members of all three police oversight bodies who are going to be sitting at the negotiating table for the first time, and members of and a representative from the city council who for the first time is going to be sitting at the negotiating table. And it's not just going to be the mayor it's not just going to be the mayor and her representatives and the Seattle Police Union representatives. That's a historic change as well.
Yes, and it gets us there. It's not the change, but it opens the door for change.
It opens the door for change. Yeah, but that in itself is a historic change, to have folks who represent accountability for the police department to be sitting at the negotiating table. That's a first here in Seattle. And I also should point out, too, we haven't been talking a whole lot about efforts to change the law at the state level, but there's been a lot of talk about introducing a bill this year in the state legislature to change the accountability for police. And the ability to prosecute police who murder people. Okay. So that is change that is in the works as well. So when you only look at, you know, a slogan as your metric, and you're only looking at budget numbers, you're not seeing the big picture. And that's particularly true with the 2021 budget. And that's why I think it was either last week or the week before, I talked about the reporting requirements that are included in the 2021 budget, so that we could get a sense for what the council is going to be working on in the coming year to try to take this project further. You know, it's not something that can be done or that can be easily done in one budget cycle and one year. It's clear to me, and it should be clear to everyone, that the council is on has their eye on the long-term goals here and is working towards that, and they feel it's a project that's going to take more than 1 year. It's going to take several years, I think. So change takes time.
Yeah,
right?
And there's also a question of, you know, not recognizing your own efficacy, because none of these changes would have happened without the protest movement this year.
That's true.
They really are forcing the change. And, you know, as
that's
a tactic,
true.
Maybe demanding that, well, this isn't enough, is helpful, but it is not helpful to talk about replacing what is already the most progressive council in the history of the city. You know, you're not going to have a whole lot of traction for that. But you can have traction, you know, turn to your supporters and say, keep going. We need to pressure these people. That's the way you need to go right now.
Yeah. In addition, I think folks who have been on the street who may be feeling burnout should maybe try working on some other – working for a little while with another tactic. There are other tactics that can be used. I mean, you can be working with groups who are engaged in the participatory budgeting process. Could be lobbying the city council. Could be working with folks who are trying to change the police accountability and ability to prosecute police at the state level. Could be working on a whole lot of different things that can further the long-term goals. And being, if you're burned out from being out in the street, if you're burned out from just lobbying city council members, there are a multitude of other tactics and other places where you can work on these same kind of issues to get to the long-term goal. So that's just kind of a little pep talk there, and also a little bit of just kind of trying to examine, okay, and put in context the work that's been done this year in terms of police accountability. Now, I think this is also something we can put in an even broader context of what's going on nationally, right? Because when the city council passed their budget on Monday, there was a whole bunch of articles in the national media about how the city of Seattle has just gone further than any other city in the nation in terms of defunding their police department. And kind of looking at, wow, these are big changes compared to what other cities are doing. So maybe putting it in that context too, that we do have not just the most progressive city council that the city that this city has ever seen, but probably the most progressive city council in the nation right now. That doesn't mean we couldn't get more progressive. It just means that remember that idea of maybe replacing city council members who are already working on this and going just an extra step or two further than any other city council in the nation carries a risk of losing to a more conservative city council member in that election. So just be mindful of that. Okay.
And the creation of Change Washington with what appears to be primarily run by people outside of Seattle is mm-hmm. another indicator of the big money, big business coalescing regionally to change Seattle politics because, you know, it all radiates out from here.
Yeah, and I think we would be attracting probably funding from all over the country to try to stop this kind of a movement. So, yeah, it's really the Change Washington group is really a sign that this is what we're going to be up against in future city council elections, not business community.
It's not like Amazon hasn't picked up some more spare money in the last year.
I know. Yeah. And so we see this group, Change Washington, where one of the leading staff people is a PR person who used to work for Amazon, right? So you better believe he's working those contacts to get money in the door in order to replace city council members here in Seattle. So there's that as well that people need to be mindful of.
And it appears to me that Change Washington must have some crossover ties with people like Tim Burgess and People for Seattle, because I magically got emails from Change Washington, again, trickle down from being on Tim Burgess's city council email list that then seemed to transfer my name over to People for Seattle and every other spinoff pro-business group that's come along.
He
didn't seem to have a problem sharing our information on that.
Interestingly, my name, I tried to sign up for one of those groups in order to get those kinds of emails, but interestingly, it booted me back off. So I think I'm on some kind of blacklist there where they won't give me any information, probably because my name stands out and is easy to recognize.
And then finally, regarding these different organizations that are working behind the scenes, they all have to be taking victory laps this month, the end of this year, because their lead person, Marilyn Strickland, former head of the Seattle Chamber of Commerce, is now a congressperson.
She was, I think, deputy. Or no, she was the head.
No, she was the head, yeah.
Yeah, because they just announced a new replacement for the
So now they've literally got someone in D.C. that's going to be going to bat for them and bringing them, you know, extra funding and extra attention and extra connections that they never would have had before. So they are going to be fully energized come the upcoming city council elections for Mosqueda and Gonzalez. Mm-hmm. And people need to be focusing on that shift in the political landscape as well.
Yeah, yes. And we've also got a huge mayor's contest coming up, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's going to, and, you know, we haven't seen a progressive mayor. We've tried. We've run good, really good candidates for mayor who have not been able to actually win that prize. So that's another place where people can be focusing their energy and working as well. If you're burned out and marching on the street, if you're tired of getting gassed by the Seattle Police Department, you know, help on those legal cases that are trying to change how the Seattle Police Department manages crowd control. Help out in political campaigns to get our progressive city council members reelected, and help out on trying to get a progressive mayor in the door at City Hall.
Update on the local and national status of the COVID pandemic.
It's bad. I shouldn't be laughing, actually, but that is the summary. We have roughly quadrupled the infection rate in King County over the last month. Over the last 2 months. And it really is at a far higher pace now than it was last spring when everything was locked down. And we're seeing an estimate with the Thanksgiving holidays, both locally and nationally, that infection rates are going to increase that much more. We're seeing locally healthcare providers start to get stressed. We also saw this past week a strike of doctors and nurses and medical tech people in 20 clinics in King County. They are striking over lack of understaffing, I should say, and then also lack of PPEs. And this is something we're starting to see around the country. We're seeing labor stoppages and burnout among healthcare workers who've been really doing overtime and very high stress situations with not adequate worker safety precautions around the country. And you're starting to see people literally quit. You're also starting to see serious shortages of ICU beds and of medical personnel to staff them around the country. And unlike last spring, when you had a hot spot here and then a hot spot there and then it would move somewhere else, now it's everywhere. All 50 states are seeing rises in cases. 47 of those 50 states are seeing have seen a 10% or more increase in the last week. So that tells you how quickly things are increasing. We are now over 13 million nationally. We are in Washington State. We are at nearly 160,000 infections, and it continues to increase at a very high rate. We've now lost as many people in Washington State as died during 9/11, and Washington State is well down the list of states' deaths. It's something like 30th. So. It's bad here, and it's that much worse in a lot of other places, particularly the Midwest, California, the Northeast is starting to spike. We saw both Los Angeles County and the city of Chicago go into basically modified lockdowns this week. They're a little more targeted than they were last spring, simply because we know more about how the virus spreads. It's primarily airborne rather than spreading by surfaces. And so, indoor situations are the biggest thing. We've seen, for instance, the huge protest movement over the past 6 months does not seem to have done much to spread the virus, because those have been outdoor protests. And also because the participants tend to wear masks, except for the cops, of course.
And except when cops use tear gas.
Yeah.
But then the folks who stay usually have gas masks on, so.
Well, in some cities. I mean, Portland
in some cities here, a lot of folks have gas masks now.
Yeah, it took a while, but that has happened, you're right.
Mm-hmm.
So the virus is looking to spread further. It was very happy with the Thanksgiving holiday, an estimated 1 million people nationally pass through U.S. airports on holiday travel on Wednesday. And, you know, epidemiologists are saying we could double our death rate by the end of the year to some 4,000 per day across the U.S. And, you know, you have to wonder.
And I think our new infection rate across the U.S. is around hovering around 200,000 a day. Is that correct?
Yeah, it was 205 yesterday.
Okay.
And it's continuing to increase. I believe Wednesday was the first day that it officially was over 200, and then it increased by another 5,000 yesterday. So it's continuing to go up. And, you know, we'll see what it's going to be in a week and a half, once the Thanksgiving holiday impact starts to be felt. But the real question is, can our healthcare system accommodate it? You know, we're seeing real stresses in local hospital systems. We're seeing serious shortages of healthcare personnel in a lot of different states. Several jurisdictions have now encouraged people who are, who test positive for COVID to continue coming into work as long as they're asymptomatic, which I don't think that's very sensible, because people can be asymptomatic and still shed the virus. But it tells you just how desperate these hospitals are for personnel, because, they have been putting in long, long hours. People have been staying home from work because they don't want to get the virus and because they're exhausted. And, these hospitals are running out of ICU beds. The entire state of Indiana has no ICU beds available as of today. So it really is bad. It's bad, especially in the Midwest.
It's really bad in rural hospitals who are scrambling around trying to find beds in inner city hospitals to take overflow patients. And the inner city hospitals are already at capacity and can't take a lot of those patients. So we're not just talking about, COVID-19 patients. We're talking about people who have ordinary problems like heart conditions, cancer treatment, people who just come in with like a shingles infection that needs to be treated. Those people with respiratory illnesses that are aside from COVID-19 go into the hospital and they're having to wait hours before they even get seen by a doctor. Some of them have to lay on a gurney in a hospital hallway, or they are just sitting in the waiting room, just waiting hours to get treated. And that is truly terrible. And I think we're fairly soon, if not already, going to start seeing people die from preventable illnesses in addition to COVID-19 because of the shortage of hospital beds and hospital personnel.
Yeah, I think we're at risk, by the end of next month of really looking at a collapse of our healthcare system, which is terrifying. And we've seen that before, in February and March in the initial infection in Italy. People may remember there was an extremely high death toll. And that wasn't just because we didn't know as much about how to treat the virus. It was also because you had a modern healthcare system, European healthcare system, that was completely overloaded, and where people couldn't be treated for ordinary conditions. And the death rate was extremely high. And I think we may be heading that way again in the U.S. this year.
You add on top of that the number of people who haven't gone in for routine screening exams this year because they were worried about COVID-19 in the summer. Doctors and nurses say they're starting to see people come in with cancers that could have been prevented or caught earlier if the person had come in for their routine exam earlier in the year. That's also, I think, those folks will also become casualties of this COVID-19 pandemic that's gotten out of control.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the vaccine, because that's everybody's great hope, is that, we'll have a vaccine by the middle of next month and that'll help turn the corner. But I just want to remind people that both of the vaccines that are ready for emergency use are two-dose vaccines. right? So they'll be provided to medical personnel first, who will get the first dose, and then they'll have to wait between 3 to 4 weeks to get the second dose. So they won't be fully protected until at least the middle or end of January at the soonest. Okay. And then from what we know about these vaccines, people often get ill when they get the vaccine. So if you've got medical personnel who are getting the first dose and they're fine, and then they get a second dose and it lays them low for 2 or 3 days, what's that going to do to our healthcare system? So there's that issue as well, not just the logistics and timing of a two-dose vaccine, but also the high rate of side effects from the vaccine itself could also be stressing the healthcare system as well in December and January.
This is true. And I would add to that, the CDC is going to actually vote on its distribution priorities next Tuesday. Right now, the proposal is, as you say, to have healthcare workers and other essential workers receive the first doses, and then nursing home residents, long-term care facilities, which make up almost exactly 50% of the fatalities in Washington State, for example, and a number of other states are like that, too. That's second, and then immunocompromised people and people who are medically vulnerable would be third, and then after that it would go to the general public. So we're probably looking at spring at best before we see widespread distribution to the general public. It's going to be a while.
Probably summer.
Yeah, it's going to be a while. Now we will hopefully see an incoming Biden administration act more aggressively to try and contain the spread of the pandemic. Right now we've got a president who can barely bring himself to mention, as 2,300 people died yesterday directly from the virus. But he's basically fiddling with a four iron.
It's just heartbreaking to read about what some of these medical personnel are saying, that they're treating people in the hospital who are in denial that they have COVID-19 to the last breath that they take. They think they must have pneumonia or something else. I mean,
because they think the virus is a hoax. And that has been the message of right-wing media and of the president of the United States, for 8 or 9 months now. So it's not surprising that some people believe that. Mm-hmm. That those deaths are directly attributable to Donald Trump.
Yeah, they're on his scorecard, I don't know about other people, but sometimes I think, I think about my life in terms of a scorecard sometimes, do I have more in the good column or more in the bad column? And I think, someone like Donald Trump, he doesn't think about it that way. But if I think about it that way, his scorecard is loaded with stuff in the bad column.
Well, no, he cheats on his golf scorecard. Why wouldn't he cheat on his life scorecard?
Oh, well, yeah, I don't think he can.
Yeah. Well, depending on who's doing the scoring. Yeah.
Right.
But, I got to say, I've been reporting every day on the COVID pandemic since January. Mm-hmm. And as far as I'm concerned at this point, Donald Trump is a mass murderer.
Yeah.
He deserves to be tried for crimes against humanity. And, at the level of, Pol Pot and Hitler and some of these other people by the time we're done. It really is appalling, and it's appalling to witness it in real time and to realize that, for some 74 million Americans, and we'll talk about the election and his efforts to overturn that in a minute, that's just fine. They're okay with that, or they don't believe it happened, which is even more alarming. So, it's very discouraging to have to witness it. And it's going to be another almost 2 months before Biden can actually do anything to try and turn it around. And as we know with the federal government, it's kind of like steering a glacier. Those changes, he can talk about them on day one, but they will not have a real world impact immediately.
It's going to take some time. Yeah.
Yeah. And same thing for a vaccine. You know, the hope is there. There's a light at the end of the tunnel. Hopefully that will encourage people to be more diligent about social distancing and not less, and mask wearing and hand washing and all. You know, just those three things would make a huge difference. Mm-hmm. I also want to talk a little bit about Australia, because Australia, the state of Victoria, which is where Melbourne is the second most populous state, had what are called Elimination Day on Wednesday, where they had gone 28 consecutive days without any new cases, except for people coming in from out of the state. So at that point, they consider that there is no virus in the state. That's the second Australian state to achieve that. New South Wales, which is where Sydney is, that's the most populous state, will get to that point next week. And so, you know, Australia is well on its way to eliminating the virus. And we've already seen that those kind of numbers out of a handful of other countries like, you know, New Zealand, Taiwan, et cetera. The difference with Australia is it's much more like the United States culturally. You have a strong individualist ethic. You have a conservative prime minister, who, people may remember from their terrible bushfire season about a year ago, is also a climate change denialist, but he took the virus seriously. And you see, both conservative and liberal, state, premiers taking it seriously. It didn't become a partisan issue. And that's the big difference between a country like Australia and a country
they had a coordinated response that was directed from the national level, which we have completely and utterly lacked here in the United States.
Yeah. And you know, again, a lot of this goes back to the occupant in the White House and the people he surrounds himself with. And, you know, between that and climate change, you know, he has a lot to answer for.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the status of Trump's efforts to change the election results. This week, it's not going well. I mean, this week, the Trump administration formally began the transfer of power to the new Biden administration. Of course, Donald Trump has refused to concede and probably never will. But Emily Murphy, who's the administrator of the General Services Administration, she agreed to begin transferring information and funds to the Biden team. And then Donald Trump agreed to go ahead and allow that to go forward. And then Trump tried to take credit for making that decision, although Murphy issued her own statement saying that, no, Donald Trump had nothing to do with it. She had come to the decision on her own after multiple courts had ruled against the Trump legal team and some Republicans in Congress had directly urged her to start the transition on her own, including Senators Rob Portman of Ohio and Shelley Moore Capito of West Virginia. In addition, more than 100 business executives had sent an open letter to the Trump administration asking that they begin the transition process in spite of Donald Trump. And so that occurred early this week. Meanwhile, Trump vowed to continue to try to change the vote tally in his favor. On Monday, Pennsylvania State Supreme Court decision, then followed on Friday by a federal appeals court decision, rejected the Trump legal team's request to issue an emergency injunction to prevent the certification of ballots in Pennsylvania. And now the Trump legal team is saying that they're going to go to the Supreme Court with that case. In the appeals court decision, however, the judge wrote, quote, charges of unfairness are serious, but calling an election unfair does not make it so. Charges require specific allegations and then proof. We have neither here. Voters, not lawyers, choose the president. Ballots, not briefs, decide elections, end quote. And that was what was written in by the appeals court for the third district. And that's what the Trump legal team is going to try to take to the U.S. Supreme Court. And I don't think even with Amy Coney Barrett on the Supreme Court that they have a case.
No, I think it's highly unlikely the Supreme Court will even take the case.
No. And even if the U.S. Supreme Court decides in favor of Trump on this case, there are not enough questionable ballots in Pennsylvania to overturn Biden's 81,000 vote lead in that state. So on Tuesday, Pennsylvania Secretary of State Kathy Buchvar certified Joe Biden as the winner in Pennsylvania. and indicated that Pennsylvania will be sending electors to vote for Joe Biden to the Electoral College. And yes. Then also in a major defeat to the Trump legal team, the Michigan Canvassing Board voted on Monday to approve Biden as the winner in Michigan. So that's a closed case as well.
Yeah, so the five states that the Trump team was really targeting to overturn the election results of swing states of Nevada, Arizona, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia have all now certified Biden as the winner. And so legally speaking, those states have to send electors for Joe Biden to the Electoral College vote. All states need to have their electors certified by December 8th, and the Electoral College itself will vote on December 14th. And at that point, it will become official that Joe Biden will be the next president.
Yeah. So the door's closing on any ability for the Trump legal team to try to change the outcome.
At least legally.
At least legally, yeah. So,
That's ever slowed Trump down in the past.
Yeah, let's talk about Joe Biden's cabinet appointees, since he announced six of them this week.
Yeah, and we've still got some really key ones that have not been announced, particularly Attorney General.
Those will be in the coming weeks, I'm sure. But the ones he did announce this week, at the top of the list was his pick for Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. He was a member of the National Security Council under Bill Clinton from 1994 to 2001. He also wrote foreign policy speeches for Clinton while he was in office. Blinken was also Biden's top aide when Joe Biden served on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And then Blinken was a supporter then of the 2003 invasion of Iraq. When Biden became vice president, he brought Blinken with him as his first national security advisor. And then Barack Obama appointed him to be deputy secretary of state. The New York Times describes Blinken as, quote, a centrist with a streak of interventionism, end quote, which I think puts it pretty mildly, actually, given Blinken's support for U.S. intervention in Syria, in Libya, and support for U.S. providing weapons to Saudi Arabia for their carpet bombing campaign in Yemen. He's a big supporter of that as well. He also worked to limit immigration by refugees into the United States, and he supports working with Central American nations to control refugee populations and keep them in their home countries. So I would say he's a darling of the conservatives in Congress, and that's one of the reasons why Joe Biden appointed him. But I think he also reflects Biden's preference for interventionism.
Biden, as head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, was extremely hawkish, one of the most hawkish members of the Democratic caucus. And I don't think those instincts have gone away. I think we're we're going to have a lot to protest in the next 4 years in terms of foreign policy and war making.
Yeah. Now, Biden also announced his national security advisor will be Jake Sullivan, who has served as head of policy planning under Hillary Clinton when she was Secretary of State in the first Obama term. Sullivan also worked on Hillary Clinton's 2008 campaign for president and is a pal of the Clintons. After Hillary Clinton left Obama's cabinet, Sullivan stayed in government. He followed in Blinken's shoes and became the national security advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, which is how Biden knows him. Sullivan took a key role in negotiating the nuclear agreement with Iran in 2015. He also has many, many admirers among conservative Republicans because, just like Biden, he's known for reaching across the aisle to get consensus on foreign policy issues, which means he probably is also a hawk, like Antony Blinken and Joe Biden as well. So that's Biden's national security advisor. Then Biden also announced Linda Thomas-Greenfield as ambassador to the United Nations and that he would restore that position to a cabinet level status. Linda Thomas Greenfield is his first black appointee, and Biden has committed to diversity in his cabinet. So that is kind of interesting. She has served as Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs in the Department of State's Bureau of African Affairs from 2013 to 2017. She joined the Foreign Service in 1982 and worked her way up the ladder until in 2017 she was part of a group of folks who were terminated by the Trump administration in a purge of senior State Department officials so that he could replace those folks with his own appointees. As a former career diplomat, she's been serving on Biden's transition team to work on efforts to restore the State Department to its former glory and to provide some kind of support for career Foreign Service officials. So folks who are career Foreign Service officials are going to see her as a really good pick for ambassador to the United Nations. I have no other information on her her own political views in terms of interventionism or U.S. foreign policy. I guess we're going to find out what those are as time goes on.
Yeah, and she's really going to be a point person. Along with a couple of the other picks that we're going to go through for trying to restore alliances, because Trump has done enormous damage to North Atlantic and other alliances around the world and to the standing of the United States, honestly. That's not something that's going to be easily repaired. And, you know, because foreign policy has been so capricious for the last 4 years, a lot of our allies don't trust us at this point, and for good reason.
Yeah.
And so she will play a key role there at the UN in trying to, lead diplomatic initiatives with other countries.
Yeah, and that takes me to the fourth person that Biden announced for his new incoming administration, John Kerry. As his in a new position of international climate envoy. Of course, John Kerry was the former Secretary of State under the Obama administration after Hillary Clinton left. He was key to negotiating the Paris Climate Accord. He's going to be expected to deal with the global community on limiting greenhouse gas emissions and transitioning the world to a green energy future. For domestic greenhouse gas policy, however, Biden is going to appoint a separate White House climate director, although he hasn't announced who that will be yet. Kerry's portfolio is going to be working with the international community. So by choosing John Kerry, essentially Biden has picked somebody who's a familiar face to the global community, somebody that has worked with international leaders before for the Obama administration. Of course, Kerry is known for his incrementalism on climate change solutions and his past support for using natural gas to replace coal. Natural gas is not necessarily cleaner because of the way that methane is released when oil and gas companies frack for natural gas.
And that's one of the major criticisms that environmentalists have had of Biden's climate change policy. Is his continuing support for fracking. So, to me, if you're going to have a climate czar, which is what the press is calling this position, you can go one of two ways. You can go with somebody who is an institutionalist, who's a familiar face in international circles, and who carries a lot of credibility just from his past history, or you can go with somebody who is, known as a climate activist and somebody who's really forward thinking on those issues.
Kerry is not that.
and Biden went with the familiar face. And this is something we're seeing in, I think, a lot of it, if not all of his cabinet picks, is that they are institutionalists. They are incrementalists. They are people who are familiar faces around D.C., even if they're not household names. And this is the approach we're going to see to the Biden administration, I think.
And then, let's move on quickly because we don't have a whole lot of time left.
No, that's true.
Avril Haines is going to be Biden's pick for Director of National Intelligence, and she'll be the first woman in that position. She served as Deputy Director of the CIA under the Obama administration before she moved up to Deputy National Security Advisor. She had earlier served as Deputy Chief Counsel to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee when Joe Biden was chairman of that committee. She was also a legal counselor to the National Security Council under Barack Obama, playing a leading role in helping Obama to expand the drone assassination program and other legally questionable anti-terrorism programs. So she's a big supporter of those. Some folks have said that she's pushed for transparency on those programs, but I have to say there wasn't a whole lot of transparency that I'm aware of for the drone assassination campaign. So I don't have a whole lot of confidence in that. She's also a career foreign service official, which I think should please some of the wonks in the State Department and the intelligence services. But again, an intelligence insider who, although some people say she's for transparency and open government, I'm just not seeing the actual
I'm very skeptical about
stuff
that
to
too.
Support that claim.
And there's also no transparency in terms of we don't know what the budgets for those programs are like or whether they're going to increase under Biden. And we won't find out. We won't necessarily know if these sorts of targeted assassinations are being carried out around the world. And that should concern a lot of people.
Yeah. And then, his sixth appointee, Janet Yellen, for Treasury Secretary. She will also be the first woman in that position. She was the first woman to lead the Federal Reserve. She's also a renowned labor economist and supporter of safety net programs, although she's criticized the federal government for taking on too much debt and has talked in the past about making cuts to Social Security, which of course leads to the question, where does she stand on increasing taxes on the wealthy, which Joe Biden has pledged to do? We just don't know anything. I don't know anything at all about her stance on tax policy. She's also,
although the stock market really spiked this week on news of her potential announcement. So that's a little worrisome.
That's an indication that she may not be for increasing taxes on the wealthy and on shareholders. She'll also have to work on reversing the Trump administration tariffs, particularly on European goods. She's a notable free trade supporter, which doesn't always mesh with her stated pro-labor stance. And we'll see how she fares with negotiating a COVID-19 economic aid package with the Republicans in the Senate. She supports aid to state and local governments while the Republicans are opposed to that. And we also don't know her stance on trade with China and Pacific Rim countries or whether she thinks economic sanctions are a good tool for furthering the United States' foreign policy goals. Those are questions that I'll have as we go forward with Janet Yellen as Treasury Secretary. The plus is that she at least knows, she is at least an economist and knows how to do that job, whereas with the Trump administration, we didn't always get people who even understood what the job would require.
Yeah, we've been kind of critical of these picks, but I have to say every one of them is still an upgrade over the current occupant.
Yeah.
Every single one.
And then finally, one more pick he had this week was Alejandro Mayorkas, the Secretary of the Department of Homeland Security. He was Deputy Homeland Security Secretary from 2013 to 2016 in the Obama administration. He started out the Obama administration as Director of the Citizenship and Immigration Services. So he, again, an agency insider to run the Department of Homeland Security. He's Cuban-American. He will have to deal with sorting out the Trump administration's horrendous immigration policies, including family separations, the treatment of unaccompanied migrant children, the horrifying conditions in detention facilities at the southern border, and an enormous backlog of asylum cases in immigration courts. And then, of course, there's the border wall fiasco, which he will have to untangle. So
there's something like 150 or something different initiatives in immigration policy that the Trump administration has taken, and they're all bad. And so there's a tremendous amount that will have to be reversed or untangled. And you know, the damage that's already been done is irretrievable. It's just a question of where do you go from here?
Yeah.
And it's going to be hard.
Oh, yeah.
All right. Well, with that, we are pretty much out of time.
Mm-hmm.
another week of uplifting commentary and insight.
Yeah. It's your feel-good hour.
Yes, it is.
And we'll be doing this all again next week.
Yes, we will.
Yes, we will. All right.